Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today I'm joined by Makone Maja. Just a quick note, I had lots of problems with sound recently, and hopefully that doesn't follow through into this episode. I've been working to try and work out exactly what the problem is, but it has been a little bit elusive, so apologies for that. But let's get into the news of today. We're going to be talking about Helen Zille's candidacy for the mayorship of Johannesburg. We're going to be talking about attempts to ban alcohol advertising. And we're going to be talking about ambulance shortages in South Africa. So on our first topic, we have, of course, talked about it in the lead-up to this. I discussed it briefly with Viv for Mark when she was doing the podcast report last week. But there is now the official announcement of Helen Zille's candidacy for the city of Johannesburg. She sort of launched it by describing herself as a daughter of Johannesburg because she is originally from Joburg, although in recent years she's become more associated with the Western Cape and Cape Town. She is originally actually from Joburg. She grew up in Berea and Orange Grove and was born in Heelbrow. Actually, that was the first place that I was born as well. So actually, it's from my part of the world. But anyway, speaking at a rally announcing this in Soweto, she said Johannesburg can't. She said that it was the place to be once in South Africa. Now, over 30 years later, many see it as the place to flee. It is South Africa's most devastating example of what bad government can do to good people. She said, many of you know me as an ex-mayor and ex-premier, a mother and a gogo. I'm here today as a daughter of Johannesburg, where I took my first breath. I took my first steps and took my first words. It's here that I rented my first flat and found my first job. I fell in love here, and I fell in love with the city and all her people. She then also made some jokes about Ramaphosa endorsing DA governance when it comes to clean audits. Makone, you know, we've had a lot of discussions about this internally and also on the podcast a few times. I've talked about this. You know, what do we think are Ozilla's chances? Do we think that she's, I mean, I think both of us are agreed that she's probably the best candidate that we can think of for Joburg in terms of her ability to actually do the job. But the question of being elected is a much more contentious one. There have been, I think, two columns by Tom Eaton recently, kind of pouring water on the idea. You can see in the Ferial Huffage's piece in the Daily Maverick that she's a little bit skeptical of, what was the phrase she used? Something along the lines of that the Margaret Thatcher Western white matriarch politics won't wash in Johannesburg, and so Zille is trying to soften her image. And when you look at the electoral numbers, you see that the DA does have a long way to grow. Their high watermark, I believe, was the election where I got elected. I'm sure there's absolutely no connection there whatsoever. It was back in 2016 where the DA got about 38% of the vote. They took a hit in the 2021 election. The DA went down to 25% of the vote in Joburg, and then it got around sort of 24-25 in the national election vote. So, you know, if the DA wants to have a stable coalition government, Helen doesn't just have to score in the high 30s. If she doesn't want to have to rely on parties that don't really like the DA, like Action SA, she's probably going to have to get in the high 40s. What do you make of all this?
Sure, the numbers really make it quite intimidating. Sounds like a very huge leap for Helen Zille to acquire all those votes. So far, the only contender that I'm aware of that is a candidate for the Johannesburg mayor election is Kenny Kunene of the Patriotic Alliance. And I'm not sure, but from where I'm sitting, I think it's an easy choice for people who are voting to consider whether they go for Helen Zille or Kenny Kunene. I think she has... It's actually Gayton McKenzie who was commenting about Mpopalatse and said she's a nice lady, but she doesn't have that krach, you know, that like that mama action, which is what they call Nomvula Mgonyane, former premier of Gauteng. She doesn't have that personality, that fire, that, you know, school principal vibe that you look for in a mayor, which Helen Zille does. And so, and has way in abundance in comparison to somebody like Kenny Kunene, with other problems, corruption allegations included, affecting Kenny's image right now. But you mentioned a few pieces that have been written about her from Tom Eaton and Daily Maverick. There's also the interview that's now heard all over the country, I believe, between her and Annelem Dota, who is, you know, this big broadcaster on 702 and in South African media. That I think that's where you really get to experience Helen Zille. I don't think that people are transmitting who the Helen Zille, the candidate, is through the Daily Maverick. I think they'll be looking for podcasts. They'll be looking for interviews. They'll be looking to hear from the source directly rather than read what the media is trying to get them to perceive Helen Zille to be. And I think she did two things really well in that 702 interview. As somebody who's burnt my fingers interviewing Helen Zille, I think she parked her campaign vehicle on making comparisons between why Cape Town works and why Johannesburg doesn't work. So there's a moment there where she says, you know, Johannesburg replaces 17 kilometers of water infrastructure pipelines a year, where Cape Town's been doing 200 kilometers annually for 20 years, right? So obviously Cape Town is, it's stunning from the outside. You know, the roads are paved. It's got all the things working for it. But what she said there is beneath that, that glitter that is Cape Town, it's grounded and anchored in years, decades of maintenance, of, you know, merit-based appointments, of corruption-free governance. And 94.7, that's rather than 702. So I think she really contrasted very well what she could offer and bring to the table in Joburg. And I also think she showed that, like, abrasiveness that for me bodes well and not so well for her, right? Because I think there's an extent to which it borders on, like, bully, like, intimidation of journalists, where it seems she takes every criticism that is made, whether about the DA or on her, including ones that we've all heard about, you know, the DA being a party that caters for the white audience, or, you know, white suburban rich people. I'm not sure how you could still be offended by those comments. I'm sure she's dealt with them so many times at this point. She'd have no problem clearing them, as she only she can, right? So I really thought she showed her strength and some of her weaknesses. I also said that the comments about Blacks hating refugees are found to be unbecoming, particularly of a non-racialist. But I think she has this to offer for South African democracy at large, which is, and I'm quite optimistic about this, where we get to a point where group identity politics are irrelevant when people are picking candidates for whom will govern over their, you know, local government elections. Because I think people will be considering, is it important that she is an old white lady, or, you know, that Joburg CBD is finally cleaned up? And it's clear, the DA's record speaks for itself. So does Helen Zille's. People, I've read a few comment sections and she says she doesn't regard them at all. But I actually want to see what people are saying. And other than the polls being the most instructive on this sort of thing. But so far, people are keep mentioning, you know, the award she won as Mayor of the Year against 840 other, you know, cities or towns. So her record clearly speaks for itself. And I think she has that to offer the South African, the legacy of South African democracy moving forward, is that, you know, that boogeyman of the white man coming back to govern in South Africa that the ANC holds over Black people, vulnerable people, let me say, vulnerable communities over their heads, and keeps them locked in fear to not even think of any alternatives that are not Black or brown. Helen, I think Helen Zille is the person to break, you know, that stronghold that the ANC has manipulatively held over particularly rural and township communities. And so I think it's like the GNU, you know, they've offered us this rush and this surgence of accountability, of genuine substantive political discourse, I think she has something similar to offer, where really the color of someone's skin becomes irrelevant, because what I really care about is that there's water coming through my taps, there's electricity, that the roads are paved, that there's freaking lights in the city of gold, right? So I think we may be approaching that era, and I can't see who other than Helen Zille is the person that gets us crossing over, you know, that finishing line for us liberals who are also staunch non-racialists and who are tired of race politics making and rearing its ugly head again every other election cycle. But again, she has to be careful about the things she says moving forward in her campaign, which I'm sure she will.
So, I mean, I wish for that as well. It's all I've ever wished for, really, in our politics, is that we can sort of escape the shadows and cliches of our past. But sort of on this question, and I think this is sort of the great debate about trying to work out exactly how well Helen is going to do. I mean, obviously, there's, you know, the numbers are big for the DA to get any kind of secure, stable coalition in Johannesburg. It's possible when you do the math. The DA doesn't have to grow that much in a lot of places. It just needs to turn out its voters, and the ANC and the other, you know, parties need to have sort of go backwards. The DA needs to eat a lot of those Action SA voters back into the party. It also needs to hold off the PA, and it needs to chip away at the ANC where it can, particularly in some of its strongholds. And if they just do all of those things, they can win. Like I said, long shot, but it's not certainly not impossible. But the sort of central question here about Zilla's candidacy is this kind of, you know, how that sort of view she gives of the tough, no nonsense person. There's two sort of interpretations you can have. You can have the positive interpretation, which is that she's honest, she's straightforward, she's authentic, she tells you what she thinks, she does the job, she doesn't get caught up in too many things. And, you know, when you attack her, she comes back after you because she's, you know, not willing to let nonsense fly, right? That's a sort of appealing version of the story, is that Zilla is a, you know, no-nonsense, hardworking, focused politician who you can trust to always be looking out for you, even if you wouldn't necessarily invite her out for a night drinking. The alternative sort of spin on this, and this is one that you can see in some of the criticism of her, is that the sort of that she seems like she's lecturing you, like she's shouting at you, like she's bullying you, like that you can't necessarily trust her because she's going to move you around like a chess piece on a board, something like that. That's the kind of, you know, what Hafiji described as Western white matriarch politics. Now, I think that is not a great phrase. I do not like that phrase. It's sort of tinged with all sorts of things. But put that aside. Makone, you know, so as you say, you know, there's, you know, sometimes Helen says things that people take umbrage over. How, you know, it's one thing to say, how do you, you know, she must be careful about what she says, like you said now. But what does that actually mean? I mean, what are the sort of notes you think she has to hit in her campaign in order to kind of avoid being basically thought of as a meanie, to put it simply? You know, what specifically, like, what kind of cul-de-sacs must she avoid? What kind of message can she sort of focus on to ensure that she wins?
Yeah, I think we need to hear a plan. What is her plan for cleaning up Johannesburg? I think that's where she may intellectually convince people to vote for her. But I also think voting is more of an emotional exercise than it is, you know, rational and logical for a lot of people. They have to like you. And I think a moment of likability for her in that Anilemdoda interview is where she does something that a few, like many liberals, are few to a place, she goes to a place where I think many liberals are quite reluctant to go to, is where she addresses the deficiencies in many South African households, you know, the lack of and the absence of fatherness, the absence of parental involvement in the upbringing, in the nurturing, in the education, actual parenting of their children. And that humanizes a person. That is such an accessible figure that people can really connect with her. And so a lot of that, I think, makes her, it takes away from, you know, that caricature that Hafiji paints of a matriarch Western white. I can't even finish that sentence, but it actually makes a human out of her. So I'm not really sure how you say to someone, don't be so offended by questions that I perceive to be perfectly teed up for someone of, as I've said, her political repertoire to perfectly clear. Everyone always remarks over how, you know, she speaks like a teacher. She makes sure you understand exactly what she's saying. She doesn't use these bombastic words and bombastic concepts. And that's a great, she even said, you know, ideology is irrelevant. What we really need is simple water, streetlights, roads to work. So I'm not really sure how you can say to somebody, don't be so offended, but see it, perceive it to be an opportunity for you to demonstrate the successes of your party and the potential and the opportunities for growth of your campaign and how you aim to address questions that are being raised, or how you already have addressed questions that have been raised. And I, this doesn't take away from her spunk. You know, the moment she said, there was a mic drop moment where she says, who made you the spokesperson for Black people? I mean, that's great, punchy, you know, it's funny. It hits right on the head, and people are tired of being spoken for, right? That's why I said people are not going to read Daily Maverick to decide what to think about Helen. They want to hear from her directly. People are tired of being projected as things that they may not be through, you know, the media. So yeah, I'm not really sure what else to say about that, but I think she went a few places in that interview that also demonstrated that there's nothing to fear about liberalism being in governments, which the ANC has also had, you know, a monopoly over dictating to people what liberals or what capitalists or what a free market enterprise or what merit-based appointments look like. I think with her in government and with the DA and the GNU, people have been able to see, you know, there's actually nothing to fear here. But again, it's that there's a huge leap here to be made. Yeah, it's also very early days. It's almost a year or longer.
Yeah, we've got at the minimum a year. It may be longer. I think I can't remember the exact earliest date that the election could be, but it's sort of August, September, I think, next year. But it's probably going to be later. In fact, there's some speculation that it will be in maybe February or January of 2027. But still, things are heating up, and we'll obviously cover it very closely. Right. So next story we're just going to be talking about, it's actually on some of those themes of sort of personal responsibility and such. South Africa has a big alcohol problem. A lot of South Africans drink far too much. A lot of the violence and murder in this country is people fighting, often in a setting where people are drunk, people who are drunk driving, fetal alcohol syndrome. You know, we have a lot of social costs from people abusing alcohol, and so it's understandable that you see legislation recently there's an EFF private members bill looking to have alcohol advertising banned in South Africa. And this is not the first attempt at this, of course. During the COVID lockdown, we just sort of randomly had this, not quite randomly, but just very sort of thinly kind of explained and reasoned ban on alcohol inserted into the lockdown. We've had, over the last couple of years, there have been numerous attempts to ban either alcohol advertising or raise the drinking age from 18 to 21. You know, this is not a new thing from the government. And there's sort of two things that come to mind in this discussion. Firstly, McCorn, I'd like your thoughts on, this whole topic of, you know, whether it's a good idea to ban alcohol advertising. I kind of think no. I kind of think this is just sort of just like raising the drinking age. You're not really actually going to make a big difference to this kind of thing. But just from the politics perspective, you know, we've seen the EFF trying to kind of re-energize itself after it seems to be in the doldrums recently. And I made fun of the fact that Malema said the things the EFF was going to do to re-energize itself were, and then he proceeded to say things the ANC already does. But this is yet another thing, which is that, you know, you've got this EFF MP calling for a ban on alcohol advertising, which is once again another ANC policy, showing, I think, that the EFF has absolutely no ideas other than we will just be the ANC, but more. Anyway, your thoughts on all of that, McCormick?
Can't be said any better, Nick. I think this is symptomatic of a country that is, or people that have lost faith in their government and the capacity, the authority, the legitimacy of their government, and so are looking for other areas in which to, low-hanging fruit areas in which to centralize government control and to reassert and reconstruct, you know, a fragmented or weakening state by grabbing like small amounts of power where they can. And this is that, like you're saying, to what extent is alcohol advertising responsible for alcohol consumption in the country? And I think they'll quickly learn that not much. And then my concern is, what's the next step after that? Is it to like have alcohol curfews? Is this to like limit the amount of alcohol that people are allowed to drink before it's criminalized? And it's those small amounts of power grabs that eventually become visibly disturbing and quite big. And so I think the EFF is right to be concerned about the level of alcohol consumption in the country. Like you said, every year we have these Arrive Alive campaigns that are meant to deter people from drinking and driving and to curb the amount of fatalities on us on South African roads, just the amount of blood spillage on South African roads every festive season because people lack self-control. But I think what we need is a better enforcement of the laws on our books, right? Specifically on drinking and driving. A lot of people are able to pay their way out of, you know, facing arrest time when they are drinking and driving, right? Like, people already know the hotspots, for example, where JMPD hangs around late at nights, and they know, like, you know, to have enough cash to be able to evade jail time. Although my understanding is actually that the JMPD is not as forgiving anymore, which is a good thing, but we need more of that. We need cops that are willing to really see to it that we have a zero tolerance policy on things like drinking and driving, and better awareness campaigns about the extent to which alcoholism has a generational legacy on families, on people's ability, like how people's household spending, for example. I was telling you about, you know, a similar conversation that's being held over the emergence and the rise of sports betting and online gambling, and how, you know, StatsSA says that sports betting or online gambling or gambling in general actually now accounts for 54%, over 50% of household spending on leisure fun activities. And that's terrifying, that people are spending more on gambling than on like reading or doing their hair and their nails, like things like that. That's frightening. And so you may be able to address alcohol, but, you know, then you'll have people swap alcohol for a different vice. And I think the conversation we really need to have there is about individual discipline and self-control. And address, I think there's a level of human suffering that's being masked by these statistics, you know, that people are filling voids with alcohol and gambling. And it's devastating families, but I'm not sure that this is really the response that we need to talk people off the ledge and to really get them to appreciate the consequences of depleting one's salary on gambling and on drinking.
You know, when it comes to topics like this, I'm always never that in. We've actually had this discussion about sports betting. I'm never keen on banning things too much. I think that it often has lots of costs, some of which are hidden, that only become apparent later once you actually enact a ban like this, and that it doesn't really solve the problem, right? It just sort of pushes things underground, particularly alcohol. You know, every time alcohol prohibition has been tried basically anywhere in the world, you know, alcohol is very strongly embedded in many cultures around the world, and South Africa is one of those places. And so sort of rooting it out with the diktat of law is almost impossible. And also, you know, there's that argument to be just said that, you know, people can enjoy things like drinking and even getting drunk sometimes is no problem. It's just when it becomes habitual and destroys your life and becomes true abuse. And I do think that we have this problem when kind of analyzing this. There's sort of people on the left only want to talk about socioeconomic reasons for why people get into alcohol. I'll say, it's poverty. And people on the right almost only want to talk about, it's moral decay and social and individual choices that. And it's all about the fact that people aren't going to church enough or whatever. And the truth is, it's actually probably a bit of both, right? When people are in strong communities and strong families, they are much less likely to fall into some of these vices. And at the same time, when people have wealth and prospects and education and all those things, they can also help them resist. So you kind of need an approach of both, right? You need to have a country which provides opportunity through things like economic growth, which creates jobs and stuff. You have something to lose. And at the same time, you need society, not government, not the state, not laws, but you need society, you need community groups, you need churches, you need just the sort of cultural forces to push back on alcohol and say, look, like, if you're being drunk, you're embarrassing yourself and your family if you're being drunk in public. If you are neglecting your kids because you're spending your money on booze, then you are a disgrace. That social shame that is a very important part of solving these problems. And that takes time, you know? And it's not satisfying to people because people want a law. They want just like a wave of the hand to fix the problem. Mm-hmm. The truth is, to fix these problems, it requires much more individual and community action on top of creating this enabling environment. And, you know, this is one of the reasons I think why we push so strongly for a focus on economic growth. It's not going to solve alcohol abuse, but it's going to open the door to society actually having the resources and the energy to begin to solve a problem like that. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I fully agree. It is a multifaceted or multi-pronged approach. And it really is about anchoring one in community. And I also think that shame tends to be an undervalued and underutilized nowadays. You know, like we live in a shameless culture, but I do think it's more effective and more personal than, you know, the government, a government bureaucrat ever can in helping a family or an individual get off the bottle or lay off the betting casino machines. So I do think that you're right that, you know, sometimes government interventions tends to just exacerbate issues, and it also tends to be lead rather to overreach, and that's a fear to consider. But I think the embrace of alcohol has also come because as shame culture has declined, let me say.
Okay, last story for today. Not terribly unexpected, but kind of horrifying news nonetheless. Recent investigation into the number of ambulances working in parts of South Africa, particularly the Eastern Cape and KZN, have revealed, firstly, that there's not that many ambulances. There's only 480 in KZN, for example. And in KZN, only 37% of those 480 are working. In the Eastern Cape, that number is 418 ambulances, and only 30% are working, which is straight up bonkers. Makone, you know, when we talked about this before the show, you just said those three letters, NHI.
Shameful. That's what the statistic is. Speaking of shame. But exactly, the NHI. How does a government that cannot even dispatch ambulances, and by the way, ambulances already have a lot of like structural issues getting to people that need urgent care, right? When we as the RR launched one of our bills that addresses expropriation, offers an alternative to expropriation. We did this in Bramfisherville, and it doesn't have, it's a township in Soweto, it doesn't have paved roads. And one of the things the communities were lamenting is that we can't even get ambulances to come here because the roads are so poorly constructed that the ambulance doesn't know that it'll actually make it out, right? So the communities have to carry the person that needs help out and bring them to the road, like to the tar road, so that they can then be taken to the hospital by the ambulance. So already you have all these problems, you know, with dispatching ambulances to remote areas, to townships, so it is not remote, to a township. And then you add this, the fact that there are not even enough ambulances that are operational, that can service our communities and service our townships, let alone, you know, the idea of a centralized pool of money that the government can use to, you know, service everybody's healthcare. It's insane that there are such low hanging fruit and easy fixes to things like there not being enough ambulances, that we must dream of the sophistication of a model where, you know, the government gets to control health insurance and access to healthcare. South Africa is truly the girl that lives way beyond her means, and she dreams like it, and she forces everybody, her ideas down everybody's throats, even when it's clear that it's implausible. And so it is a shame that we have a Department of Healthcare that ignores getting the basics right, because it describes corporates and South Africans who have access to healthcare and want to retain it. It describes them as greed. But is there greater greed than this, to like dip into the pockets of people who are already funding the existing model of healthcare when the existing model of healthcare is in the state that it's in? Like, what you're doing now is expanding this healthcare that is thrust upon the South African people. This is the quality of healthcare that will emerge from the NHI, where there are not enough hospitals, where there are not enough equipment, where doctors are inadequate, where, you know, hospitals are just in complete shambles. The NHI should not even be a conversation that we're having when you have bare minimum level of healthcare that is being offered to South Africans. And this is not a problem that money is going to fix, right? Healthcare and education are two big spenders, and welfare, three big spenders on
management.
Actually, maybe debt servicing costs now. But, you know, those are like where the bulk of government spending goes. And clearly that's not able to, it's about, like you said, it's about management. How are you wielding those resources? How are you actually plucking the money that you're getting so that it does the things that it needs to achieve? And so, The NHI seriously needs to be on the back burner for at least 1,000 years.
So, you know, I've recently, on account of my arm being broken recently and all that, been interacting quite a lot recently with the private healthcare system. And, you know, I know there's horror stories, everyone has horror stories, but it has been, in my experience recently, a genuinely great and positive experience. And that is borne out, you know, in data as well about the health outcomes. The government's policy should be trying to get as many South Africans onto the private health system as possible, in my view. We should be making it so that more people can afford it. And you can do that, firstly, by loosening up some of the regulations for what kind of packages healthcare providers can provide, so that they can offer more low-cost options to more people. And also creating jobs, growing the economy so that people can buy their own healthcare systems. If every South African could afford to pay for their own healthcare system, we would for their own healthcare, we would be in such a better place, and they would be in such a better place, and we wouldn't have to rely on, you know. Hopefully, there's enough money in the tender budget left over to buy an ambulance or fix an ambulance this week, and that we won't just pass away because some cater somewhere stole all the money that was supposed to go to our healthcare. Utter madness. Anyway, Corne, thank you very much for your time today. Interesting discussion. Hopefully the sound problems are much better this episode. Do leave a comment if they are not. But with that being said, thank you very much, everyone. We hope you had a enjoyable, or at least interesting, experience today. And we will be back, not tomorrow, because tomorrow is, of course, Heritage Day, but on Thursday with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.